The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
If the opposition can smell blood this year, we're as well pack it in, because even if Comerford's kickouts are as good as Cluxton's, every team is taking a step forward.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now. OTB
AM. It wasn't just our dreams that died yesterday. It was potentially the career of Roger Federer. So maybe none of you got the opportunity to see this. You were otherwise occupied. Colin Buig is with us, though, to put a cap on the most magnificent of the tennis careers. It may not end up being the winningest, but certainly it has been the most thrilling. It was the one that inspired grown men to write bad poetry. Colin, that was the end.
It was kind of Federer to make room for the England-Denmark match. That was about the only positive I was grasping to yesterday. It was sad. It was sad to watch. It was kind of like Muhammad Ali towards the end against Larry Holmes or Trevor Berbick. It was watching a great getting embarrassed. And that's what it was in the third set when he lost 6-love. The only other time he's lost 6-love in the entire century was the 2008 French Open final against Rafael Nadal, when he also lost the third set, 6-love. That was just weeks before the pair engaged in probably the greatest tennis match ever. And the only other time he's lost 6-love on grass was the previous century, the 1999 Queen's Tournament, which Kathleen McNamee tweeted about yesterday. Thought it was a great stat, and it encapsulated just how amazing and mercurial and effervescent and every lovely adjective you want to describe Federer is on grass. But yesterday he was beaten by the far superior man, and Hubert Hurkacz, as solid as he is, as ruthless as he can be, should never be beating Federer like that. But, you know, Federer is a few weeks shy of his 40th birthday. Age has caught up with him.
Is there a possibility that the injuries clear up and he gets strength back at some point this year, next year, and that this isn't the end? I mean, you know, you think about the stats came up for Jimmy Connors' number of wins at Wimbledon, and they were ridiculous. But then you remember that he did go on to his 40s and would come back, and we just keep playing and have the crack and, like, be a bit of a heritage act, like, kind of, you know, you two are still banging out those massive 100 million, 500 million concert tours, play the arena, come, do your thing, get beaten in the quarterfinals by somebody. Is that Federer's future? Or, as McEnroe was saying, nah, he cannot make peace with the fact that he's not going to be the winner.
No, I think Federer is only interested in the Joshua tree. I don't think he wants to be touring in his middle age. Like, I think he's different to Andy Murray, because Murray won the first two rounds at this year's Wimbledon, and after his first round victory over Basilashvili, he was saying on his on-court post-match interview, because they're starting to do that now in centre court after every match with the winner, which is actually a great addition, he was saying to the crowd, like, I don't know why you all want me to retire so much, I want to keep on playing, I love the sport, to raucous applause. I think Federer just wants to win. If he can't win the tournament, I don't think he's that interested in playing. I think that making the quarterfinal in his fifth tournament back after a 14-month layoff is very impressive. And actually, the pre-tournament predictions were that he would get knocked out from the quarterfinal. But he wasn't supposed to be playing Hubert Hurkacz. He should have been playing world number two and second seed Daniil Medvedev. But Hurkacz beat him in the fourth round. And I think if he had lost to Medvedev, it would be more palatable. But even if it was peak Djokovic, losing 6-love is such a cruel way to go. And it wasn't like it was a 6-love like it was at last year's French Open final between Djokovic and Nadal, when Nadal took the first set in that scoreline, when Djokovic got the juice and advantage a lot. Hurkacz destroyed Federer in less than half an hour. But look, you're right to think about alternative positives. The first set, okay, it wasn't that close. Hurkacz in no time went up 5-2. But Federer got back into it. It was a kind of respectable scoreline. The second set, Federer went 3-love up. He got a break at the start of that set, and that went to a tiebreak. And at 2-3 in the tiebreak, Federer had a 1-in-a-million slip right at the net, an open goal equivalent volley to an open court, and he slipped. And Hurkacz went 4-2 up, got the mini break, and took the set away.
And then he collapsed.
The third set is the collapse. And the third set it caused that John McEnroe quote, which just struck me. I mean, it was so simple, and it was, you know, a very basic encapsulation of what happened. But just the way that McEnroe said, I can't believe that just happened. Pause. As quickly as it did. And Federer was bending down and picking up his bags and made a very rapid exit. And in the post-match press conference, you know, he didn't deny the fact that, yeah, this could well be his last time playing on centre court, but to end it in six love after winning the tournament eight times. It's cruel.
I tweeted that it reminded me of the scene in The Boat in The Sopranos where Bobby Bacala is sitting there with Tony Soprano asking, you know, what's it like when you die? And Bobby says at the end, you probably don't hear anything. Everything just goes black. That six love was it. Wimbledon fading to black for Roger Federer and us all kind of sitting there shocked for a few minutes, wondering if the TV was working. Emma was saying she turned it off. She couldn't watch.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of tennis fans were like that.
Yeah.
So you're right to bring up the slip because there's this amazing slow-mo of the crowd's face. Somebody screams while the ball is in the air, despite the fact the umpire has, in the previous break, said, would you all shut up? Stop screaming in the middle of points, essentially, except in his polite British way. I'm not sure he's British, but you get my sense. And then the slip is so egregious, but there's a brilliant slow-mo of just the crowd, which is obviously how Alfred Hitchcock filmed tennis brilliantly in his movies. And it was Hitchcockian. It was like this tapestry of faces, but the horror on their faces as what they're watching unfolds, where it's like joy because he's about to smash it, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh Jesus. And that's the end. When the movie of his incredible career comes to be written, they'll just show that shot from the crowd, and that's the end. And it's like cinematic, and in a way it's fitting that the end is so brutal and severe, because that's what he would have done to people along the way. He would have ended anybody's career if he could have, he had to win. He's a cutthroat killer. And at the end here, we're like, oh, he's nice. He's selling all those rackets and clothes and credit cards and whatever it is. But actually, at its heart, Federer was a cold, hard killer who played a beautiful game and sports brutal.
It's really interesting to hear that was Emma's reaction, because it kind of was like watching a great stand-up comedian not be funny anymore. And everyone getting a bit uncomfortable. And that's what the third set was. I saw that tweet of yours. I was afraid you'd reference it because I haven't seen that show. So I would have had to go along with it. I'd have been nodding along to you. But
Spoiled a bit for Owen because he hasn't got there yet either. I mean, I thought you millennials were supposed to use COVID to catch up on this shit. Yeah. Do your homework.
Another rep. It's a neat summary because He did used to embarrass people in the mid-noughties. I mean, he had that run of winning five Wimbledons in a row. And at the end, I mean, I think the 2007 final was also against Nadal. That wasn't competitive, really. And at that stage, you kind of started to hate Federer a bit. I was actually, a friend of mine texted me yesterday towards the end of the third set. And he was like, do you remember when we used to hate him?
Yeah.
Because he's that dominant. You know, it was no fun.
No.
It was like watching PSG and Man City. It was like these guys, it's like he's an unfair advantage because he's a genetic freak.
Well, there was that.
He doesn't sweat and he's too easy for him.
There was that era where Tiger was winning everything by 10 shots, where Michael Schumacher ruined Formula One by being so much better than everybody else. And Federer kind of ruined tennis by not having rivals. But then eventually the rivals came and they are going to knock him off his perch. And that's sad, but again, that is the game, and the game stays the game.
But it's been a slow decline, really, since the 2010s, because he hasn't won the French Open since 2009, which is the only time he won it. And he hasn't won the US Open since the 2000s either. And really, when Novak Djokovic got his act together and changed up his diet and became a much fitter player in 2011 onwards, he started dominating, and Rafa Nadal continued his French Open dominance, and there wasn't much room left for Federer. He sprinkled the odd Grand Slam here and there. I mean, he only won Wimbledon 3 years ago, which is, you know, people probably forget. Or sorry, 2017. But he won the Australian Open 3 years ago. So it's not that long ago he's winning Grand Slams. But it's been a real sharp decline because of the injury layoff. And now he's so human looking. And I don't want to see Federer like this, you know? And I mean, as I said, Hubert Hurkacz is a fine player. He's 14th seed. He won the Miami Open earlier this year, which is a Masters 1000 event with very significant ranking points. Beat a lot of very good players. And he's the highest ranked player Federer has played since Federer's return. But, you know, he's at best ruthless when he's hitting well. And he was attacking Federer's backhand constantly in this match. And Federer's footwork was atrocious. I mean, the slip I completely forgive him about because it was just that, it was a slip. But he could not get his feet sorted for ground strokes in the baseline. Yeah. And Hurkacz kept on targeting him. And that was the say it again, the same word, that was the cruelty of it, because Hurkacz, who Federer is his hero, that's exactly how he was targeting him. Like Federer would have targeted Hurkacz back in the 2000s, because Federer would have done this to the type of player that Hurkacz is in the last decade.
Yeah.
And, you know, time has no respect for anybody. And that's kind of the beauty of sport at the same time.
Yeah, they're calling it a humiliation in the papers. And like,
the third set was, not the first two.
Well, I know, but part of me thinks he should come back and have like a goodbye tour where he announces to everybody, this is my last one. And so he plays every match in centre court. And, you know, because he, like...
I just don't think so.
I don't think so either. But
that's another 12 months away, you know. He'll be nearly 41. I think he'll play the US Open this summer. I think that's what people should be focusing on.
See, I'm not sure he will after that. I think that's up for grabs now, isn't it?
No, well, I mean, he's only playing to win. Right? So if he doesn't think he can win, he won't play the Grand Slams, that is. He might play other tournaments. I think he'll play the US Open with one last chance to win it. A Hail Mary, if you will. But then he has to wait all the way till January for the next slam. And that's another 6 months away, and his body could be six more months in decline. But he, you know, in the post-match press conference, while he said, I don't know if I'm going to play next year, and it was quite downbeat, he also said, well, I want to give myself some time to get properly match fit and just sharper in general. He actually said matches weren't really the issue. It was just finding that form and fitness and training. So he could give himself a few more months. But, you know, as far as his centre court aspiration goes, unless he plays a seniors tour and comes back for several highlights, which I'm sure he will over the years, I think that would be his last ATP match there. And he still hasn't decided on the Olympics. He still hasn't made a decision whether he's going to play. And I think it would be great if he did, because that's best of three and it's a depleted field. And he'll have huge support in Japan. His clothing line is Japanese. He's massive support over there. But he hasn't made a decision on it. I don't think he's that bothered. I think he just wants the Grand Slams. And you can blame him. He deserves to pick and choose, doesn't he?
You mentioned there that it's obviously been a while since Federer has won a slam, so maybe it was never going to make that much of a difference. But the draw looked tougher with Federer there in the context of Novak Djokovic. Men's tennis just looks tougher when Roger Federer is around. And it's based on reputation only, but that's the way it seems. Are you concerned at all about the men's game going in a direction where Djokovic's stranglehold gets even tighter? It is a stranglehold right now, but it gets even tighter. And the prophecy made on the show by Jenny Claffey the other morning does come through, that not only does Djokovic healthily beat the Grand Slam record, but he gets to 30.
I was kind of nodding along with Jenny when she was saying that on OTBM this week, because maybe 30 is slightly out of reach, but it's not unrealistic either. And like we're saying this about a 34-year-old man, Djokovic, and he could have 11 more Grand Slams in him, but he could, because he's clear favorite for three of the four slams every year, and he'll play for at least another 3 to 4 years, and he's probably favoured for all four now after beating Nadal at the French. In terms of Federer's danger at Wimbledon for Djokovic, only on paper.
Yeah.
Only on paper. Like Djokovic has beaten Federer three times in the final recently, 2014, 15 and 19 at Wimbledon. And like Federer had two championship points 2 years ago. That was his chance. No, it's not. Men's tennis isn't a good place. It's just Djokovic is Messi and Ronaldo and the rest are Haaland and Kane. Like, it's in terms of the contenders. Like, Matteo Berrettini's a fine, fine player. He's in the semi-final against Hurkacz. He won Queens, the warm-up tournament, and he's only dropped two sets so far. And Denis Shapovalov, who Djokovic is playing in the semi-final, is a brilliant Canadian. He dismantled Andy Murray and is a very exciting left-hander. And there's loads of other players. Alexander Zverev, Stefanos Tsitsipas, Daniel Medvedev, Dominic Thiem. There's enough. But it's just Djokovic is so much better than the rest. Just like Federer was so much better than the rest in the 2000s. It doesn't mean it's uncompetitive. It just means that somebody has to take three sets off Djokovic. That's the problem with this. They can all beat them in best of three. Best of five is a different story. But Djokovic is the outlier. And the rest of men's tennis is very healthy. That's the best way I can say it. But I don't think Federer was a threat to Djokovic at all. I think Djokovic would have wanted Federer in the final.
Oh, yeah, totally. Because he would have annihilated him.
Mm. Yeah. More than Berrettini.
It would have been a humiliation, and that would have been much harder for...
Well, that's a good question. Would that have been worse?
Yes. Yes. Not even close. Djokovic humiliating Federer in Wimbledon. Because it kind of has happened, hasn't it?
He's never humiliated him, but he's beaten him well in 2014, 2015, 2019. Federer should have won it.
But there's nothing wrong, guys, again, to come back to it, with reality being put in front of you that, like, you've obviously got a relatively complicated relationship with Federer or Cullen, but...
Excuse me, how did you start the show with today being a national day of mourning just because reality's been put in front of you? Excuse me.
Yeah, well, the reality of the tennis game is different to the reality of the football game. Let me tell you, it is vastly different.
Is it?
It is, because I say it is, okay, and I can contradict myself okay. In any way I like. But I do think that you would be getting wound up a little bit by the romanticism of Roger Federer rather than realizing that he's actually up against a force that is greater than anything else we've ever seen in tennis.
I think the comparison with Muhammad Ali at the start was brilliant, though, because like it's really difficult to watch.
Yeah, it was eyes closed or either do what Emma did and walk away. It was one or the other. At least in this competition, you've finally come around to Nick Kyrgios. So that's good.
Yeah, we need to do a revisit.
It was a great text to get.
It's important, I think, that we open our mind to these things. It's mad that Nick Kyrgios is now the saviour of tennis. Like, how that happened, and how it happened quickly, we blinked and it was like, oh, Kyrgios, geez, he's great, isn't he?
I'm having Djokovic as the saviour of tennis after all these conversations we've had on the show over the last little while, just to see, look on screen there. This is what we're here for. This is why we come to work every morning, to see Djer like that, to see Colin trying to justify Roger Federer's existence. I think Djokovic is saving the sport right now, and if it's making people like you look like that, then I think that's a positive one for me.
Owen playing to the YouTube crowd.
Yeah, try his diet, Owen. Let's see how you get on. It's maybe you can end up playing for Kerry. It's not too late. We make a rule of never talking about Piers Morgan on this show. We don't make a rule like that, but I'm inventing one now.
Speak
right
for yourself.
It's a good rule, right? And I'm trying to stick to it, but I can't because he's involved. He's somehow managed to butt his way into the tennis conversation. And unfortunately, the people in tennis have bitten and have taken the bait. My favourite quote about pressure in sport: there is no pressure in test cricket. Real pressure is when you're flying a mosquito with a Messerschmitt up your arse, says Keith Miller, who is some cricketer. I don't know who he is, right? I'm not a cricket historian. I don't know who Keith Miller is, but there's a picture of him walking off and being clapped off. So I presume he was like a good stiff upper lip British cricketer who, by the sounds of it, flew a plane in some conflict at some point, right? Two World Wars and one World Cup. CC at Andy_Murray. Andy Murray makes the fatal mistake of getting involved. Now, maybe they've already been involved, I don't know. I had tuned out of Piers Morgan. No question, flying a flight or plane in the war would be unbelievably stressful. Pressure comes in many different forms. You praised Jorginho for how he handled incredible pressure yesterday. What's your point? Piers Morgan is like, yes, I got bait, that's so sucked in. My point is that pressure is all relative. Sporting pressure is nothing like the pressure many people have to face in the real world. If you want to be a top sportsman, you have to handle the heat and should never quit. I know you agree with this, so just say, you're right, Piers. Call me daddy. And then the first reply is absolutely never quit, and him, Piers Morgan, that is, storming off because somebody said that he was talking nonsense about taking the knee. I think it was about taking the knee.
It was Meghan Markle, wasn't it?
Yeah, was it Meghan Markle?
Yeah, I think
this
it was.
Is absolutely diabolical behaviour. Sorry, can't do this. And then Andy Roddick, I don't know where, decides, right, I'm going to have a little piece of this too. Andy Roddick comes in and has that gif of him walking off. Then, hi mate, I'm talking to a Wimbledon champion, so maybe sit this one out, says Piers Morgan. And then, fair play, I'll have my seat. You can have your hypocrisy. I will say that between you and I, one of us was number one at our job. You've had your attention now. And then it's like, I've got 7.9 million Twitter followers. You've already got 1.4. Oh, do the math, buddy, and pipe down. That's it. But I presume this is all about Raducanu and that is what that conversation is about?
Yeah, yeah. It's full bullshit. Like, Raducanu was suffering towards the end of the first set against Tomljanovic, just like any player suffers with any injury, and couldn't continue the match. And I mean, that's it, really. And thankfully, she was okay. But she was physically affected by the enormity of the situation. It caught up with her, but it's not like it was mental weakness. It just physically caught up with her, and she physically couldn't play anymore, and she was advised not to by the medics. And she didn't play, and she's 18-year-olds. It was her first ever real tournament, let alone Grand Slam, let alone Wimbledon. And she'll be back. The discard was ridiculous. The fallout was unbelievable. I mean, it should have just been completely respected that, yeah, she couldn't continue playing anymore, just like Serena Williams couldn't continue playing after the first round when she got injured midway through the first set, just like Kyrgios had to pull out against Felix Auger-Aliassime. It's just a withdrawal, but people have jumped on it. And I hope she has good people around her. I think she does, because it sounds like nonsense.
Even that day, Colin, but before she started, before she even went out, there was like multiple different montages on BBC. You see a British player come along, and it doesn't matter what ranking they are, it doesn't matter what their immediate ceiling is. If they're in the middle rounds of Wimbledon, England just goes into a state of frenzy, not unlike that of the national football team, for example. And I think it's an even higher, more pressurised scenario to be in Raducanu's situation than to be on the football team, bizarrely, even though I would have always thought that the England football team were under the worst pressure of any sports football team in the world, or a sports team in the world. And I think what we've seen this week is actually, no, being a young British tennis player is an awful place to be.
Well, you're on your own. I mean, that's the first thing. It's an individual sport, so at least the footballers can confide in each other if they're feeling down. And they can share that stress and experience. But with Raducanu, she was interviewed by Sue Barker, and Sue was asking her, how many people had you played in front of before Wimbledon? What was the max capacity? And she said, oh, maybe a couple of hundred. So that's how her life has dramatically changed in the last week.
Yeah.
Besides all that, even if she was an experienced pro at 29 years of age and won a couple of Grand Slams, she withdrew because she physically couldn't continue playing. And that should have been where it ended. But you're right, Owen, they completely overhyped her. They put her on BBC One weeknight, no Euros, and they wanted millions to watch her, which is fair enough. It's clever producing, but they just amped up the pressure, and she hadn't beaten anyone of massive significance. She just had really good results.
Okay.
Too much.
Colin,
too
good
soon.
Stuff. Thanks a million for that. Cheers.
OTB AM.